Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're about to listen to a conversation I had with Krista Tippett the other week at an event sponsored by the Aspen Institute. This conversation was taped the day after the election. So those references you hear about the election happening yesterday is because we taped it the next day. Krista Tippett is the creator and host of one of the best NPR shows and podcasts around called On Being. President Barack Obama awarded her the National Humanities Medal, and she joins us to talk about her book, Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. Enjoy the conversation, folks. Welcome, everybody. Good to be with you all. Good to be with Krista Tippett. She's one of the people I admire the most in public radio, and I mean that sincerely. I remember when we first met, when you just were starting the radio show at the Public Radio Directors Conference and trotted that out.
I want to say I'm so happy to be here with Mark. I know there are a lot of entrepreneurs in this room, and you know when you do something that nobody's quite done this way before, rather than jumping up and down and saying, hey, great idea, people raise their eyebrows. And there was a lot of nervousness in public radio about a show on this subject and whether it could be as intelligent and balanced and whether it would just inflame and exclude. And Mark was, I mean, I remember this so well because we had just, it was really more hypothetical than it was real.
Right.
I thought it was possible, but I couldn't really prove it. And you came up to me and said, this is a great idea. This is something public radio needs.
One of the things that struck me about this moment of this book, Becoming Wise, and Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. And as I was reading it over the last bunch of days, I thought about this is such an appropriate time for this book to be here at this moment. That we can look, we need a time of kind of wisdom, you know, of searching for that in where we are. And I was thinking the words body, love, faith, hope that you explode so deeply. And I don't know. I know you didn't plan this. You had no idea that this election was going to be as crazy as it is, or where we find ourselves. But I think, in many ways, well, let me just read this one piece to you, because this is where I want to start. I want to start inside the book here. One of the great ongoing debates in the history of mathematics is whether mathematics is invented or discovered. Did Einstein invite E equals mc squared, or did he discover it embedded in the fabric of reality, waiting to be seen? In human life and in the history of faith, I think love has a quality of a bedrock reality we discover. Adventurers, travelers, each of us only fitfully apprehending its potential. I take some solace in the fact that I'm alone in this intuition that the reality of evil, of injustice, of suffering, notwithstanding, at the center of this existence is a heart beating with love. As Desmond Tutu put to you.
Desmond Tutu, yeah.
Yes, right?
Yeah.
So to me, I mean, that speaks volumes to me about the moment we're in now and what we have to begin, if we're going to look for wisdom, to search for.
Yes. I want to say, before I say anything else, that I see Richard and Amy sitting here in the front row, and it seems like, you know, I mean, we started talking about this, I don't know when, maybe a year ago, and it's so exciting that we're here. And it is a changed world. And something that started to happen with the radio show, you know, as the show has evolved, is that our public life focus has grown, you know. I think there's a renewed interest in inner life and connecting inner life with outer presence in the world, and I know younger generations are very committed to that. And asking the so what question. So we work on ourselves, and how does that matter to the world we inhabit and the world we're creating for our children and grandchildren. So that, you know, that word love, that word love comes up in lives that have been well lived. But I think culturally it's also one of the most watered, and also it's something that social reformers who have shifted the world on its axis have all called the world to love, including Martin Luther King Jr. And yet the word love is so watered down in our culture. And we have, you know, English has a kind of impoverished vocabulary. We only have this one four-letter word, whereas, you know, in the ancient Greeks talked about there is eros, which is mostly what we talk about when we talk or sing about love.
Exactly. Right.
But there's also philia, the love of friendship. There's agape, practical care, which can be extended to the neighbor or the stranger or the enemy. I have heard surfacing everywhere these last years a desire for I hear this word love surfacing. It surfaced in interesting ways, like after those terrible Orlando shootings. After a lot of our worst events. I will say I have not heard it a lot the last week since this election. I think there's been a lull, but I suspect it will reemerge. And actually, I was at a university last night, and it was a really wonderful place to be, full of searching. But I long, and I think many of us long, even if we're not necessarily putting these words around it, to figure out what love could be as a robust public force, as a piece of our civic life, as something muscular and adventurous that, you know, and something that is an action rather than a feeling.
You know, that I was going to go to words, but I just want to stay with love for a minute. There's a piece in here that really struck me. You interviewed a man who I also interviewed some time back, and his words always came to me as kind of very prescient. And that's Vincent Harding.
Yes, and we put him back on the air this week. Isn't that a great thing about radio?
Yes.
You can resurrect people from the dead. And Vincent Harding is who we wanted to hear. And, his question, is America possible?
Right. He's one of the most gentle, beautiful, powerful
thinkers. One of the great leaders of the civil rights movement.
And a lovely human being. And, again, you mind if I read a little bit of what you wrote?
That was very thrilling for you.
Before I come back to words, this is a piece he wrote, and I realized that Vincent Harding died, left us 2 years ago, passed on. But he said here, he could have written this last week or this last month. He says, I have a feeling that one of the deeper transformations that's going on now is that for the white community of America. There is this uncertainty growing about its own role, its own control, its own capacity to name the realities. It has moved into a realm of uncertainty that did not allow itself to face before. And I think that's the place we are in. And that's even more the reason why we've got to figure out what King was talking about when he was seeing the possibility of a beloved community and recognize that cannot come until some of us realize we must give up what we thought was only ours. Can we be a beloved nation? Why don't we try and see?
Yeah. Vincent also said, and I find this very comforting and helpful, he pulled back a long lens. He said, when it comes to being a multi-ethnic, multiracial, multi-religious democracy, we are a developing nation. We've been at this for about 50 years. It's a long-term project we're in. And I think that's great perspective for a moment like now.
It also is also the way you approach this work and the way you approach your work, which is to take this broad spectrum of people, not just racially, but racially, but people from every kind of faith that we can imagine on the planet, from mathematicians, from poets, from physicists, from people who may not be believers of anything in terms of like an afterlife or God, and kind of find the beauty inside of all of them, to pull out, to search for this truth, right? And you do that. And one of the ways you do it is, I could quote this again, I'll find it in a moment, but it's a word that I think in our world that means a lot, and I think too many people don't do it as human beings, all of us, and too many of us don't do it, those of us in this business, is listen.
Yeah.
And the way you define listening.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think I grew up learning about listening, and I think many of us did. So listening is being quiet while the other person says what they have to say, so that I can say what I have to say.
Unless you're in a Jewish or Italian house, it doesn't work.
and I say listening is... not actually primarily about being quiet. It's primarily about being present.
Right.
And I think listening is a basic social art, a basic social technology. But we've unlearned it. And it's not even that we've unlearned it. It's that we've learned, we've strengthened and cultivated a lot of other skills which actually work against listening. So for a few generations, we've all been trained to be good advocates for what we represent, for what we believe, for our identities. And this civil society needs, it needs us to be good at it. It needs us to be able to articulate our opinions and beliefs. But we need a bigger toolkit. It's not all we need. Listening, and I really do think this is, I think real listening is not intuitive for most of us, for Americans, the way we've been raised. So there's actually some muscle memory we have to build up around this, and it won't feel natural. Listening means that you, and so I try to break it down. I mean, what are some of the really basic attributes to cultivate? And, you know, one of them is curiosity. But even to break that down, what does that mean? That means that you actually go into an encounter, a conversation, being willing to be surprised. Actually wanting to understand, but being willing to be surprised. And if you think about the way our political and media spaces in particular are set up and how we walk into them, it's the opposite of that. Like, we know who those other people are. Like, we know who you voted for. We know what you stand for. And we think the point of our being there is to convince someone of how right we are. Sarcastically, to represent well what we stand for. This is another way we need to be able to be with each other. And we actually have to create spaces for that to happen. Because, as I said, our given spaces really aren't framed or set up for this different kind of encounter.
You know, that's one of the things, this book really spoke to me in so many ways. I really enjoyed this book a lot.
Thank you. It almost killed me to write.
I'm sure it did. It took a lot of work to get this book done, I know. Because you have to parse out the interviews, what's going to come through the interviews, what people said, remember, and connect them. It's amazing. But and listening to me, I was just thinking about something I've said all along when I talk about talking to other people. No matter if it's somebody who has an exact opposite political or philosophical or religious view from you, who's from a place that you don't accept nor even think you accept, that the truth lives in every corner. You can find it. If you can find it. And I think that's what we lose. It's part of what your book is saying, as well as is we have to be open to understanding and learning if we're going to create this beloved community. You talk about King a number of times throughout this book.
Yeah, and I think we have to be open to the humanity of the other,
right,
even if we don't agree.
Right.
And we have to do that because we are in community, because, in fact, we are in relationship, you know. We're in relationship. It can be a good relationship. It can be a bad relationship.
As
John Powell said, we are in relationship in a democracy, in a globalized world. The point is not necessarily that we reach agreement or that we change each other's minds, but how do we live together? How do we possibly come together around some questions we share, some challenges we share as a society. Again, even if we have conflicting answers, how do we come together around, you know, I think that is a very present challenge right now. With what, you know, I was in Iowa yesterday, and I heard somebody who said she lives in a neighborhood, and she and other parents she knows are very concerned about the effect of the, you know, the speech and the public behavior that was modeled for their children in this election, all on all sides, what their children picked up, how they as parents can model something or teach or make this a learning moment. And in this group of parents that she's got together, there are 8 people, and 3 of them voted for Donald Trump, and 3 of them voted for Hillary Clinton, and 2 of them, you know, didn't vote. So they're coming together around a shared human challenge, a shared question. That is, and that's a life-giving way to think about how we can gather and begin to speak and know each other again. Yeah. The thing about being present, about listening, being present, is what it implies is a self-awareness about the fact that when I enter into a conversation with you, I don't just bring my ears and my questions and my responses. I bring the life I've lived. It's in the room with us. And I have to know that you also bring the life you've lived. And I think being a generous listener is also about really wanting to create an encounter so that you can bring the best of yourself, and that I really endeavor to bring the best of myself. And sometimes that's going to mean listening past the words, right? And taking in the fullness.
Speaking of words, one of the things that in the beginning of the book, and you talk about it throughout the book, is Elizabeth Alexander, great poet, brilliant woman, incredible human being, and looking for the words that shimmer, which I thought was an incredibly good line.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that in terms of the words. Here are some of the words I love. Nourishing, edifying, redemptive, courageous, generous, winsome, I love that word, adventurous, curious, tender. I those, the words you pick say a lot. I mean, because you also have these issues with the word spirituality, and you have issues with some other words that we use too much, like you know, even love.
Love, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So the words are really important. The idea of the words that shimmer, let me add one more thing to that. The thing of the words that shimmer made me think of how you open the book as well, because you talk about one of my favorite thinkers of all time, was Teilhard de Chardin, and his notion of the noosphere. Because you can talk about that, everybody. I mean, because his way of looking at life is shimmering, you know, and how he kind of encompasses it all.
Well, I've thought a lot also through this election about how we are hardwired to be riveted by words and pictures that titillate, that excite, that scare us, And our fellow journalists, we journalists, are really good at. We hand the microphone and the camera to those people who rivet, who use words and ideas in ways that rivet. In parts of us that are excitable, but not necessarily the most sophisticated parts of us.
Exactly. Right.
Right. I mean.
Right. Right.
And it's actually, like, we're learning so much about our bodies and brains that is such useful knowledge, right? Like, to know that our amygdalas get tapped and that then we are not rising to our best human potential. We're not even, you know, people who are frightened don't think well, they don't make good decisions, they don't even act in their own best interest. That's just a fact. It's trickier. What we don't know in journalism, but I think we have to figure out if we take all this intelligence we have seriously, is now how do we rivet with words that are generative, that are good for us, that don't demoralize, that don't make people frightened, that call us to something better. And so, you know, Teilhard de Chardin, a Jesuit paleontologist at the beginning of the last century, which was a pretty dark time, which is another, I think it's good to remember this, you know. It's not worse now than it was during the First World War.
And what happened to him in World War I was horrendous. I mean, he lived through horrible battles.
But he was he was one of the first scientists to look at the evidence of human evolution, physiological, biological evolution. You know, one of the ways he said it this way, he basically foresaw the internet. He said, we have the biosphere.
This noosphere.
And human intelligence and creations and imagination will kind of wrap around the biosphere, and will have with geological effect, and that's the world we live in now, the Anthropocene. And he believed that the evolution of matter, what would follow the evolution of matter, would be the evolution of spirit. He believed in something like human spiritual evolution. He believed that just as he was looking at this primitive fossil of the Peking man, which is what they called that fossil, humans hundreds, if not millions of years from now, would look back at us spiritually, psychically, and find us correspondingly primitive. And what I find helpful in the people I've talked to about him is, you know, there's this idea that we are in the adolescence of our species. And one of the journalists I talked to, Andy Revkin, talked about how the picture of the globe we have right now, which is this picture of great advance coexisting with incredible barbarity, right? Looks very much like our pictures we can form now of what the teenage brain looks like. Like incredible intelligence, incredible creativity and possibility and risk, and also unbelievable recklessness. And, you know, potential for violence and a potential for creation. So yeah, I think Teilhard de Chardin is a person for now. The problem is he did think in geologic time.
Right.
And so that means we have a long adolescence ahead of us. And I say this week, I don't see us pulling out of it kind of fast forward.
No, I don't think so either this week at all. Which is why I'm glad I read this book and it helped me get through this week. I really did. I'm blocking on this man's name you wrote about, but I want to talk about him. But you'll remember as soon as I describe him to you. Who created the community where people who are mentally disabled...
Oh, yeah. Jean Vanier.
Jean Vanier, yes. Yeah. That, to me, I mean, that the heart of what, through these words, what his work is telling us and the people around him. You should tell that story. He said, I've never heard of him before.
Yeah.
I was not aware of his work.
Yeah, so a lot of the people I interview, people will say, you know, you introduced me to so many people. And we all know this. There's the world of people who are above the radar, who somehow become celebrities or household names. And then, but below the radar, in all of our sphere, all of our disciplines, there are people who are just giants in our field, right? And everybody in our field knows them, but they're not household names. And Jean Vanier is one of these people. He's a Catholic humanitarian. He was actually a philosopher and a naval officer, World War II, I think. And he's French-Canadian. He visited a friend in Paris in the 1960s, and they visited an asylum where people were sent at that time who had Down syndrome. That's what they did. And it was to him just a terrible vision of humanity. And he started this community, started very small, inviting two of these men to share life with him. And this has now become a movement that there are communities, L'Arche, it's called L'Arche, which is French for the Ark. There are L'Arche communities in 140 countries, 130 communities. So it is a movement. It's a global movement. It's quiet, right? It's 12 or 20 or 30 people at a time. And they're changing. You know, I visited a L'Arche community, and I sat down with him, which was one of the great experiences of my life. But these communities, can you argue that they change the world the way those of us who are so ambitious and educated and privileged? I don't know. They change everybody who crosses paths with them all day long, every day. And one of the he has beautiful books. You could look for his books, but you know, one of the things he says is that we fear people with disabilities, and it's not just men. You know, he mostly works with intellectual disabilities, but because they carry what is flawed on the outside, And that's terrifying for us because we spend our lives trying to keep our flaws from showing.
Right.
But we all have them, and they have inverted that. And they've created communities where all kinds of people just come and maybe spend a year with these communities, and these are communities of care. I went to their 50th anniversary. I think I mentioned that in the book because it was right when I was finishing it. Oh, what a beautiful cross-section of humanity. And so many young people who are spending a year of their life doing this, being of service and learning about tenderness. That's a word he uses. Kind of inverting the way we celebrate what is strong and appears to be perfect. And giving into, you know, this most paradoxical of religious teachings that there is strength in weakness.
There's strength and weakness, exactly. No, there is. And I think there was, it made me think of a story. One of my guests yesterday is an incredibly wonderful artist, does amazing work, and he told me a story about, and I thought about this because of the book, that he, when he was a little boy, in his particular school, when they studied pottery, they brought in these developmentally disabled kids to teach them pottery. Tell them, don't be afraid of the fire. You can do this. How you do this? And then they would take the class, and then they went through their class the next day. I never heard of that before, but it made me think of this. You know, just what that does to people to be able to kind of open up and not be afraid,
yeah,
and understand all of our humanity. You know, and all of this. One of the things you always explore is through these words and through all these stories and interviews. Is, and I said this a little earlier, but I really want to explore it in more depth. Is the religious, spiritual thinkers that we have, even though the word spiritual bothers you, I can tell from your book as well. Mm-hmm. They're thinkers, the philosophers, the interaction between them and the poets, but then the mathematicians and the physicists, mm-hmm, and those who may not necessarily believe in, but have the way you explore a physicist's notion of reality, mm-hmm, and how that fits into a deeper philosophical view of reality, and how they actually intertwine and meet. They're not separate the way we think they have to be separate.
Yeah.
Right?
They're in interplay. I think that the entire science-religion clash is a fabrication.
Amen to that. Yes.
It's not true to the history of religion, and it's not true to the history of science. They're not looking at the same realities of human life and reaching different competing conclusions. They are looking sometimes at the same realities of human life, sometimes looking at very different realities and asking different questions. So that's one thing. And what I started to, I guess, interviewing scientists is not something I expected when I started the show. Like when I made that presentation at PRPD or whatever that was, I don't think I had any idea that physicists would be like my favorite guests. But what I started to realize as I kind of walked into this territory of this part of life and all the ways it manifests in the 21st century is this fascinating development that in our time, physicists and neuroscientists and evolutionary biologists are walking some of the same territory that was the territory of philosophers and theologians in past centuries, because they are illuminating, you know, not just these questions of our place in the cosmos, but also taking the virtues that have traditionally been carried forward by religion into the laboratory, and examining compassion and forgiveness and empathy. There's these people at Berkeley working on awe, the human experience of awe, and looking at it biologically and physiologically and in terms of the brain. And there's this beautiful conversation that's happening now between scientists and theologians. And it's not about whether we can agree on whether God exists. Like, I don't even think that's in the room, that question, which is unanswerable, because mm-hmm, nobody can prove it and nobody can disprove it. But It's about this shared human territory. I think it's one of the most amazing developments of our time, and it's underpublicized.
That was Krista Tippett. Her latest book we were talking about, called Becoming Wise, an inquiry into the mystery and art of living. Krista Tippett's also the creator and host of the NPR show and podcast On Being. Let's take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we're going to hear the rest of this intriguing conversation. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back, folks. It's Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show, on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And today we're listening to a conversation that I had with Krista Tippett at an event sponsored by the Aspen Institute in Eastern Maryland last month. We had this conversation the day after Election Day. Those references are about that you hear in the course of this conversation. Krista is the creator and host of the NPR show and podcast On Being, one of my favorites and one that I actually helped bring into being in its very beginning 16 years ago, by being the first person to broadcast it on a public radio station. President Barack Obama awarded her the National Humanities Medal, and she joined us to talk about her book, Becoming Wise, an inquiry into the mystery and art of living. Enjoy the rest of this conversation.
But you interviewed Brian Greene.
Yeah, that's
right?
Good. I'm going to want you to talk about him, because that's a whole other direction for
right?
this. Yeah.
So he writes this. So you write, I'll just read this one little paragraph you wrote here.
Yeah.
As a brilliant physicist, Brian Greene explained to me, at once playfully and provocatively pushing back on the question of the reality of love, I'm composed of particles just like the table I'm writing on now. My perception that this table is solid and red or that the sky is blue is not a matter of reality. It's a projection in my mind based on the sensory input of my hands and eyes. Likewise, we intuit that time is universal, ticking off at the same rate for everyone, and this too is an illusion. The fundamental nature of reality, as far as we can grasp it now, he says, is fundamentally hidden from us at this stage in our development as a species. It's not just that I can't comprehend the true nature of forces that compose and determine my presence and action in the world. Rather, what I feel and experience and believe is leading me astray.
Yeah, so that is confounding and unsettling, and he takes it pretty much to an extreme. I mean, this is an assumption among physicists, and I've talked to other people about this, and other people nuance it in different ways, but essentially the math. And, you know, one thing I love about scientists, and Brian Greene does this too, is that they are the first people to say, I could be wrong.
Exactly.
And
right.
They are actually right. Thrilled by that possibility, because
right.
That means there's something more to learn. But they say, I could be wrong. But right now, the math we have does not have room in it for even for human free will or choice.
Right.
Which is, again, to, you know, talk about physicists being on the, you know, if physicists are debating free will, this ancient theological debate, it's totally fascinating. So I said to him, well, that must be convenient for your teenage children. He said, I had no choice. I mean, the thing that it's an interesting conversation for us to be having, because it really doesn't make sense to me that creatures as sophisticated as us could be completely living a life of illusion. I think there's another, as complicated, maybe not always sophisticated. There's another thing that he talks about. He's done a lot of thinking about the multiverse, which comes
right.
up with string theory, which is the effort to try to unify these contradictory understandings of physics at the large level and physics at the small level. And so, like, one of his scenarios in the multiverse is that the reality we experience and we ourselves are a projection, very much like a holographic projection from a real base of knowledge out there somewhere. Well, to me, that starts to sound like the God I grew up learning about as a Southern Baptist in Oklahoma. You know, when you ask the question, well, you know, who created, what is God, who created God? I mean, I feel like physicists are actually, you know, they're not calling it God, and I don't care if they do, But they are actually working at pointing at, you know, origins. And again, I just think it's fascinating. And they don't know where this is taking them either. But I have this sneaking suspicion that at some point, you know, physics, and again, whether they ever call it God, might be pointing at precisely this thing that theology has been looking for. In a language and with elements that we can't imagine now.
So I think one of the things I appreciate most about the way you approach your interviews and your writing in this book is your passion for mystery. That to me, I always make this joke with people, they say, well, what are you? Yeah, I was raised Jewish, but no, I think of myself as a mysterian. I just, to wake up every day in awe and curiosity of the great mystery that surrounds us. Who knows? Who knows? But you seem to have that awe of the mystery and are kind of struggling to find that, not struggling to find out what the mystery is, but loving the mystery itself.
Yeah. Is it Robert Coles, the great...
I love Robert Coles.
The psychologist of the spirituality of children.
Yeah.
You know, he says, mystery is a great companion. And if I... Sometimes people ask me, you know, how has this work after all these years affected me? And it's a very complicated question, and you know, some of it is in this book. But if I have to say one thing, it's my sense of mystery is to me so spacious and so present and so thrilling. And one of my favorite images is a geneticist I interviewed years ago, who's a geneticist and also an Anglican priest, and. And he talked about how he often had to keep those two sides of himself at bay. But he also said that he believes that there is a the spirituality of the scientist, there's a spirituality of scientists that is like the spirituality of a mystic, which is to say that you are always aspiring to determine as best you can what we can know and what is true. And also living in great expectation of everything you cannot yet discern.
So I think it's time to allow you all to have something to say. There's the mic back there, but as we saw erudately we put earlier, please have a question and not a thesis.
Thank you. I indeed appreciated listening to your philosophical explanation and the lilting voice of Krista and Mark Steiner. I think it went very well as an ethereal discussion. Now, I was trained as a scientist and an engineer, and we're very results-oriented. And when I have a lilting theoretical discussion, I don't get to a focused result. And so I'm thinking of our industrialists that have created, I will take Stephen Jobs, and since that's a name, I'll take the innovators because that's the computer people. I'll go with Bill Gates, and today I'll go with Elon Musk, who's got space in mind. Well, all those subjects are not lilting, they're physical, and you need results to accomplish. Well, now let's go back to our media, which has an anti-Trump or a pro-Hillary. And Trump, I might suggest, is a results-oriented person with some rough edges. But it looks like the media has gone anti-Trump. The NPR, the CNNs, the CNBCs, the Washington Post, New York Times. Question for you is, how do you quantify the liberal media being so anti-President-elect Trump, when he's more results-oriented, in my mind, rather than ethereal?
I think it's such a complicated question. I mean, I want to say, like, as a general statement, I'm appalled at the liberal media in this election and since the election. So I want to say you and I are on common ground there. I don't know if we would analyze it in the same way, but I think it's been abysmal. It was an interesting year for journalists who crossed some lines that they traditionally wouldn't cross in terms of candidate Trump. And I think a lot of it had to do with this matter of his rhetoric. which was, I mean, I think not just offensive, but damaging, you know, to our civil discourse and to common life. There were a lot of other things going on that were damaging. So that, you know, so journalists denounced a candidate in a way that they traditionally haven't. I will say, I've been so dismayed since the election at the same journalists who have one after the other acknowledged that they didn't see what was right in front of them, that they weren't in fact analyzing what was happening in our political life, now spinning these hysterical, apocalyptic, you know, they're telling the future in this apocalyptic way. And I think that is bad. That is bad for us too. I mean, so that's what I'm really, really feeling critical of. And I'm hearing a lot of people say that they just can't listen to the news right now. And I'm there too.
Yeah, I mean, I really haven't watched the news since 2000.
True confession.
You know, I read a lot, and I look at the internet and see what I want to pull out, and I look at it from all different perspectives, not just to see what's going on out there, but I can't stomach sitting down and watching television to start with, and I just don't like it, especially when I'm watching these people who think they know what they're talking about. And I think there's an arrogance to the media that, whether it's the right-wing media, left, whatever we're going to call it, right or left, conservative, liberal, whoever they are, whether it's Fox, MSNBC, they're all detached from human beings. They don't know. When you live in the world of media and everybody's making gigantic six figures and seven figures, they don't know human beings out there besides the people that make the money they make. They have no idea what's going on out there. So I think that's part of the problem. And I think that in some ways the media doesn't want to admit this, but much of it, they created Donald Trump in the primary, and now they don't know what to do with themselves. Right? So, I mean, that's part of the problem, too. So, I mean, it's a very complex question. And I think it's more than the question of liberal media. So media is not usually owned by liberals, but many people may be liberal or moderate who own them. But you have media that's so scattered now that every piece of media is remote, ideological, in their little silos. And you have to kind of parse it through, which is why I don't watch any of them. I just don't watch them anymore. I do listen to public radio, the morning edition, all things considered, the morning and afternoon. I'll drive and listen to that, but...
Not only on public life, but the next generation, our children, grandchildren. What is this? How is this influencing them?
This being what?
How is all this media influencing them? The new ways of communicating, and how is this? I mean, it's something that most of us had never seen before, never gotten our information before. And how is this going to impact them in the future?
Yeah, they're kind of a guinea pig generation, right? Because all this stuff landed on our lives. And this is the first generation of these immersive technologies. Actually, there's someone in the new generation who's here with his hand up. Maybe we... You want to speak for your generation?
All right. So, do you want me to talk to her about her?
Oh, if you want to. You had a question.
So, Gunston's been working on a philosophy club. And as a part of that club, we are planning on broadcasting a podcast. And so I'd really like to hear about from you, how would you recommend the synthesis of ideas, especially between two people who are completely opposed and will be unlikely to get anything from each other, but still make it so that the production can be relevant to the general population?
What's it about again?
It's gonna how do you make two people who are unable to compromise each other have a benefit for the general society, for the audience.
Will you say a little bit to this question of how, you know, so my, I have an 18-year-old and a 22-year-old, and they're really different in the way they work with technology. I think one thing is that we generalize about the young as though they're all, they all have the same tech habits, right. And in fact, they, you know, they're all navigating this. And so I think, and they're going to, and it's something you're going to be figuring out across your lifespans, but do you have a feeling, does it feel like a hardship, all this technology in your life?
It's an overwhelming amount of data, definitely, and it's impossible, and it makes it very difficult for anything to be trustworthy, and it so it definitely increases the skepticism within our generation, and it makes the general knowledge, it makes it so, I notice it decreases my confidence in most of, and many of my opinions.
Yeah.
I wouldn't let it decrease your confidence.
Right.
But let it challenge
whatever
you think, you know? And you asked about your podcast. I mean, I think that whenever you do things, like you let those voices speak and let them be heard and present them in ways so they can be heard honestly. You know, it'll affect your consciousness and it'll affect the consciousness of the people who are listening to it later or watching it. Is it video or audio you're doing?
Audio.
Yeah. So so you just let them speak, and then don't try to manipulate your ideas into their words as you place them out there. You know what I'm saying? We're doing a class here, but also play with sound. Play with the sound. Okay. Let the sound kind of tells part of the story that you want to have told, whatever you're doing. Yeah.
Audio is magical.
Audio is magical.
I would say the advice I would give is, and I'd be happy to, if you want to, I can give you my email if you wanted to correspond when you're doing this.
Ditto.
Yeah, but I would say invest a good amount of time in what your opening question will be. Yeah. You frame the whole, you know, everything flows from there. And it's not even just about whether it's a good question or whether it sounds good. It's how it plants people. And does it plant them in speaking about themselves? Does it call them to not just be present in terms of what they know, but also who they are, which is going to humanize the whole thing? To this question of trust, Trent Gilliss, my co-founders here, and he created all of our digital presence, and he was the one who years ago said that we should put our unedited interview on the air, which nobody else does. You know, we do that. We put my raw interview. So we create these little crafted 52-minute gems for the public radio hour. But then we also every week put out the whole messy, complete interview. And one thing we've heard from young people is that makes them trust our space. And even like listening to the sound check where I ask people to say what they had for breakfast, right? But it's like because they know that even you can listen to the crafted version, but that we're willing to create that transparency. I mean, that's why your generation has created the language of transparency.
So I'm scared. I listen to the news. Maybe I should have followed your advice and not listened to the news for however many years. But I'm also concerned as to how I, as an individual, can find out what the truths are. How can we make rational decisions when we're upset about something? Who do we go to find out what we can do to make a change? I know we can surround ourselves with people of both sides, and I'm certainly willing to do that, but I am very, very frightened. And I think I would have been frightened no matter which way it happened.
Yeah, and there's a lot of fright. There's a lot of fear out there. I don't know that I have an answer to that, but what I think we're bumping up against, and I think it was evoked in your question too, is the difference between facts and information and truth.
So should I follow Trump on Twitter, which I don't even know what Twitter is?
If you don't know what Twitter is, I would say don't start now.
I wouldn't recommend that, no.
One of the fascinating things since the election has been the surge in people reading poetry. And actually, one of our big contributions to the election cycle, we put a lot of poets on the air this year. Mm-hmm. David White, who's a great poet, said to me, I was asked poets, what is it about poetry? What is it that poetry works in us that's distinctive? And he said, poetry is language against which we have no defense. And that's a great way to distinguish between poetry and the way we've been living with language in a political election season. So I would actually say, Elizabeth Alexander, she said poetry, a line of poetry is not necessarily true, but it gets at undergirding, it's not necessarily factual, but it gets at undergirding truths. Right. And that's what we've lost, our ability to talk about, point at, grapple with, undergirding truths. And I think that's actually one of the possibilities of this moment. Can we raise that question in our midst? And again, I don't have a prescription. We have to figure out what that means. And it doesn't mean everybody agreeing.
I just want to say, first of all, Krista Tippett, I want to thank you for letting me do this tonight. This is great. An amazing book, Becoming Wise. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you all.
That was Krista Tippett. Her book, Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. Krista Tippett is a creator and host of the NPR show and podcast On Being, and I want to thank the Aspen Institute for hosting this talk and asking us to come down to tape this with Krista Tippett. We'll take a brief break, but stay with us when we come back. It's time for Sound Bites. It's Thursday. We'll be talking about renewable energy, what it means for this country under Trump, and then we talk about what it means for Maryland, how we get to this clean energy future. Can Maryland become a hub for renewable energy? We're about to find out. So stay with us. Don't go away. Right after this break, it's time for Sound Bites.